This week's episode is sponsored by Cubo Robot, who you may remember from the Web Summit episodes. Quick message from them here. Cubo Robot is the world's first puzzle-based coding robot for preschool and primary school. Support their crowdfunding campaign and save $179 with the EdTech podcast. Go to bit.ly/EdTechCubo, and that takes you to their Indiegogo page, which lifts off after Tuesday, 17th of January this week, if you're listening in real time, 8:15 a.m. UK time. And all those links are in the show notes. Now on with the show.
Hello, I'm Hannah Wilson, and this is the EdTech podcast.
Hello everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of the EdTech podcast, the show which features all the personalities behind education innovation from schools, higher education, investors, tech and more. If you're in Australia listening in, count yourself lucky, because whilst you're having a heat wave, we've had snow here in London. This week, we've got a fascinating chat with Hannah Wilson, a powerhouse in the UK education scene. Hannah has just kicked off her new role as head teacher designate of Aureus School, part of the GLF Multi-Academy Trust network of over 21 schools in the south of England. Aureus is a brand new school in Oxfordshire, which starts in September this year, with a focus on STEAM and collaboration with the community. Hannah also takes on the role of regional director for the Oxfordshire Hub and is actively recruiting for the school as we speak. Many of you will also know Hannah as the co-founder of WomenEd, a grassroots network aimed to empower women in the UK education scene, which is now launched internationally and most recently in the US. You'll also want to check out BAMEed, which launched this week with the aim at increasing diversity in UK schools. Finally, Hannah's previous role was as the professional learning consultant leader at Harris Federation Teaching School Alliance, where she was responsible for the CPD needs of thousands of educators. In this podcast episode, we talk about gender equality in education leadership.
We are moving women up the pipeline, but we've got additional glass ceilings being imposed.
Launching an EdTech community space at the Aureus School.
I think quite a lot of things in education is it's someone's idea about what they think will work, but actually who's actually spoken to the classroom teacher about what's going to help them make their life more manageable.
Raising awareness of DfE support and resources.
They've also got their DfE coaching pledge, which is 1,000 coaches for 1,000 coachees from International Women's Day to International Women's Day.
Where Hannah gets her confidence from.
I just think how we were brought up, it was like nothing's impossible.
Suggested reads and additional leadership networks for educators.
Maya Angelou is one of my favourite writers.
Hannah is speaking at BET 2017 in the School Leaders Summit, and I highly recommend you connect with her there if you haven't done before. The EdTech podcast will also be at BET. You can check us out doing a live podcast at the STEAM Village stage at 2 p.m. on Wednesday 25th of January or throughout the week. Make sure you like the Facebook page for live broadcast straight out of BET, and I'm looking forward to meeting as many of you listeners as possible. On that note, a big shout out to Simon Greenhalgh, British School Assistant Principal from Seoul Foreign School, who's listening in from Korea, and contacted the show to see if there are any London-based schools who could host a visit for his colleagues interested in EdTech implementation. If you fancy hosting a visit from Simon's team, let me know at theedtechpodcast@gmail.com. It was amazing also to receive all the positive feedback from listeners on the Dyslexia and Technology Takeover episode, like @trams87, Maria Lise Curran, and others, including a father and son who messaged to say they listened in together and found it useful, or followed up with Microsoft and the British Dyslexia Association for more resources. If you want more interesting content specifically with the dyslexia focus, check out the CodPast podcast for an awesome listen. I also found out last week that we have listeners tuning in whilst making tomato soup and speed walking, which was pretty cool, so keep those coming in. And finally, a big shout out to TeachMeet Resolutions this week for a great event. And for those in higher education listening in, if you want to attend the new event Digital Transformation, which runs in the UK in March, you can get a 10% discount via the EdTech podcast. Details are in the show notes. Right, on with the show. But before we start, a quick word from this week's sponsors, Cubetto from Primo Toys. Heading to BET Show 2017 this year? Visit us at BET Stand E48 for exciting talks, demos and workshops on computational thinking for early years education. Learning to code in early years is fundamental. Cubetto is the award-winning coding toy that makes it easy for both students and educators to introduce computational thinking in the classroom, with an instant solution that's fun to play, easy to integrate and already used by educators in over 90 countries. Come and meet those guys at Stand E48 and register for updates on primotoys.com/bet2017. For those who are listening, I'm sure like 99% are going to know who you are, but can you let the other 1% know who you are, what you do, very in a kind of nutshell fashion?
That's flattering. I think if they're on Twitter, they might know me, but that's probably about it. So I'm Hannah Wilson. My day job is I'm the professional learning consultant leader, a bit of a mouthful, at the Harris Federation Teaching School Alliance. So I oversee all of our training. And my wraparound hobby, job, whatever you want to call it, commitment is I co-founded Women Ed 18 months ago, which is a grassroots movement. Basically, we're a hashtag. We're a lot more than a hashtag, but that's what we are. And at Christmas, I'm leaving my day job to take on my first headship.
So I think what I wanted to do, first of all, is just focus a little bit on Women Ed. Mm-hmm. So first provocative question is, how bad are things currently?
Oh, that interesting question. In just with gender equality or yes. life or Let's, society?
No, not life. I think life's no, in yeah, gender equality, say, with leadership in the UK education sector.
It's an interesting time. I think we've definitely moving things forwards. We're shifting the dialogue. There's definitely a lot of activity. I think it just needs coordinating. So in the last 18 months, there's been a lot of investment into empowering female educators to become women leaders in education. We kind of started it, and there's been lots of other things that have kind of snowballed from there. So the Leading Women's Alliance, we've got all the different female leadership networks within all the existing networks we hook into. And then the DfE have made a big pledge. So they already had their diversity and equality grants in place, but I think we've kind of elevated it quite a lot, so there's a lot more people applying.
I remember you had that at your event that I attended, and you know, how many people know this exists in terms of support, and no one knew about
that,
it.
That is the problem. And they've also got their DfE coaching pledge, which is 1,000 coaches for 1,000 coachees from International Women's Day to International Women's Day. And I think the question about how bad is it, I think there's two quick answers. Answer one is the fact that we are shifting, we are moving women up the pipeline, but we've got additional glass ceilings being imposed. So if you just look at the data of middle and senior leaders and head teachers, there are more women taking on headships. However, when you look above headship level, with the new landscape, with the new system leadership roles, you now quite often have a female head, above her, a male regional director or executive head teacher, above that, a male CEO. So no one's collating that data. So yes, on paper, we have more female head teachers, but there's additional tiers above them. So the question would be, how much autonomy do those head teachers have?
I mean, do you have any statistics, just sort of quick overview of what the current existing problem is and, you know, where we're trying to get to in that kind of thing?
I'm not going to dodge that question, but I'm an English teacher.
Yeah.
We believe very much in Women Ed. It's about storytelling, shared experience. It is about connecting people, and it's about sharing experiences and expertise to support and empower one another. We collectively made mistakes on Twitter and social media in particular in the beginning, where data was being used, and you just get interrogated. And it's not like, I like the quote, the statement in schools, names not numbers for the children. We're the same. Like, it's, we're about the people in the community and about empowering them. Mm. And our mission statement is about empowering women to make the choice, because there can't be an assumption that everyone wants to be a leader either.
I think that's really true, yeah.
And absolutely, it's great that people want to stay in the classroom. I think it's sad when people say, I'm just a teacher, because actually that's diminishing their role. Last night's SLT chat was looking at talent spotting and how to grow potential and how to support progression. And there were some lovely ideas. And I just think we need to be a bit more creative about different pathways for progression. Mm-hmm. And equally, we need to rethink what a leader is. I think we've got a very traditional perspective about who a leader is. And 10 years ago, if you'd asked me that question, I would say they're tall, they're loud, they have presence. And I think we've shifted a lot as a profession and as a society, but we're not really reflecting that in our schools.
So it could be the whole notion of supporting introverts as well, who have a lot to offer and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so a really good person who's writing a book about that is Aisha Small, who works for LKMCO. And she's an amazing speaker, and she's now doing these two roles where she's in school and she's doing her research policy bit. And she's writing this book about the fact that there's different ways to lead. We talk a lot about kind of like gender stereotype roles. And I also feel for the men who don't want to be that macho male leader as well, because there's different ways to be a leader in whatever hat you're wearing, gender, race, sexuality. And I just think we need to be a bit more open, a bit more flexible about what it actually means to be a leader.
Yeah, I mean, even this weekend I was having a conversation and it made me realise, you know, I think the discussions that take place about work-life balance, they pretty much always focus on what that means for women. So women trying to achieve work-life balance, but actually the same pressures of juggling home and work are there for men as well. It's just not
absolutely
focused on as much.
And it's an interesting sort of school of thought about it's impossible to balance it. It should be work-life separation. And actually work-life balance is almost a bit of a dichotomy in itself.
Yeah.
But I also, when people talk to me about my own work-life balance, my own well-being, like I don't stop being Hannah the teacher and start being Hannah the leader and then stop being Hannah the leader and start being Hannah Woman Ed. That is my identity. It's all evolved into one.
And they all support one another.
They all support one another. And I've had this really interesting year doing this quite unique role where all my different worlds have kind of collided and evolved into one. And working for a really big, successful Matt brings a lot of experience and expertise to Women Ed, but working at Women Ed brings a lot of perspective to Harris and my new trust, my new boss. So I think it's about the value you can bring and the ideas you can bring more than anything.
But basically, we are acknowledging there is a problem currently, I suppose.
Well, there is. But the bottom line is we've got more women teachers, which isn't reflecting the number of women head teachers, and that's exacerbated by the new every school academy, every academy in a MAC kind of landscape. That my fear is, once you're a CEO of a MAC, that's a job for life. And at the moment, it's jobs for the boys. And we see all the speculation in the press about how much they're being paid. And I just think it's making sure that we get women up at that level. And I'm really excited about moving into my new region, because my regional schools commissioner, Martin Post, and the deputy regional schools commissioner, Dame Kate Deathbridge, they are the only region, I believe, who are running activity for looking at what a female CEO would look like. What would a female executive head teacher, how can we open these doors? So I was invited to a meeting at the DfE, I think it was back in September, and about 25 of us from, so my new region falls under South Central and North West London. So there's 30 female heads, executive heads in the room. We've got another one next week. So I'm excited that they seem to have their finger on the pulse about it.
So that's really interesting. So again, I remember this from the Women Ed meeting I came along to, which is, you know, perhaps the current structures of leadership are reflective of what has suited what's usually a male in that position. And, you know, actually, can we innovate the actual structure or the actual look of that role so that it's still really effective leadership, but it allows for, you know, what someone else coming into that role may need in order to be supported to do their job?
Absolutely. So I'm in the process of preparing my keynote for the SSAT conference, and my title is The Challenges and the Solutions for Women Leaders in Education. And I've looked at just that. So one of my big criticisms is we're very traditional in our mindset about a leader's working hours, and that's whether you're male or female, that there's an expectation, you're in early, you're there late, you do all the events, and there's no kind of like differentiation or distinction between you as a teacher and you as a leader. actually the most innovative head teachers are the ones who divorce the two. So you are a geography teacher and you will teach 3 days as a geography teacher, but then your TLR, being a head of geography, you can do a day from home and you're paid for 4 days. You do 3 4 days teaching and a day from home. Those kind of opportunities lend flexibility because you don't need to be in the building to be a leader. Actually, although a lot of it is actually more management and operational, I just think we're not looking at other professions about how to retain and develop staff. And I've really thought about it as a designated head teacher about how can I create those flexible roles? How can I create the job shares, the part-time work? How can I have a role where it doesn't matter what time you come in, as long as you do your teaching, as long as you meet your deadlines, you make the role work for you? And there's a lot of big institutions like Teach First who do that. And I think the tricky bit is your teaching is always going to be ring-fenced, but there are ways to make the other bits mm-hmm. more flexible. And I know established head teachers will listen to me and think I'm being really naive, but something has got to shift.
Yeah.
And if I, as the co-founder of Women Ed and a head teacher, can't find creative solutions and model the fact that there are ways to do things differently, which will appeal to a different demographic.
Yep.
So one of the statistics from the Guardian conference I went to back in the spring was that the highest percentage of people leaving the education system are women between 30 and 39. Like penny drops, isn't it? It's women who either want to have children or have just had children and can't see themselves creating that role. We've got all these qualified women who are teachers who aren't in the system, who are at home or seeking other opportunities. Why can't we create those flexible roles to get them back into the profession? So when everyone keeps going about the recruitment crisis, no, it's a retention crisis.
Yeah.
How can we get the qualified teachers to actually stay in schools rather than becoming consultants and independent and covering their bills that way?
That resonates a lot. So you mentioned your new role. I mean, well, I'd like to go right back to the beginning, and I had a quick look at, you know,
my LinkedIn profile.
This is your life. Yeah, your LinkedIn profile. And it's quite interesting. So you did post-colonial literature.
I did a really interesting degree. Okay.
I did the same
did
degree.
Did you? At UKC?
No, but at Sussex University. But right. It was basically, yeah, a lot of it covered post-colonial literature. So I wrote down some of the things. We read Cracking India, Bapsi Sidwar, I think that is. Wide Sargasso Sea.
Brilliant. So I think that's probably where a lot of these seeds got sown. With my equality hat, my diversity hat, that I always loved English, I always loved reading, but I hated Hardy, Chaucer. I didn't hate Shakespeare, but I didn't want to
have a bit of Chaucer.
I didn't want to do an English degree
yeah.
where it was literally books by old white middle-aged men.
Yeah, which is like the A-level syllabus now, right?
Absolutely. Well, yeah, every syllabus these days. So I looked at degrees, and I'd actually spent 3 months volunteering in Ghana. When I was in Ghana, I found out about this playwright called Amma Atterdu. And then the book I was reading when I was in Ghana, this when I was 19, was Paradise by Abdulrazak Gurnah, who's a Tanzanian writer, and he'd been nominated for the Booker Prize. And it was that combination of events with me volunteering, reading the play, reading the book, just sowed this seed. And Abdulrazak was doing whatever you call it, like a secondment at UKC in
Kent. Okay, yeah.
So I'd actually applied to go to Manchester and do media studies, because I thought I'd go into TV production, and I saw this course, and I basically completely changed my destiny by doing this 3-year course where I basically read feisty black feminist texts for 3 years, which completely inspired me. So I think that's probably where some of these seeds were sown.
And do you think your volunteering work as well had an effect on your approach to leadership?
I think I get asked these kind of questions quite a lot, like, why are you so confident? How are you like you are? And you have to imagine, who made you?
Where are you from, by the way?
What are your parents like? Well, that's an interesting question. So my mum's Canadian. Well, yeah. she was born in Canada, but moved back here when she was 9, 10. And I was brought up in Devon. Devon Lass, but I haven't got the accent. And my parents brought me up very open-minded, lots of travelling. But my parents are both self-employed. They're both real grafters.
Yes. So quite entrepreneurial in the family.
Yeah, there was a work ethic there. I had a Saturday job from the age of 11 through to 21, which paid my way, bought my own first car, paid for myself to go to uni. So there was it was very much, nothing's going to be given to you, you need to work really hard for it.
And were they Thatcherites, or...?
Don't get me going on my dad's politics. Yes, we don't see eye to eye when it comes to politics.
But I think in terms of that self-starting... ideology. Absolutely. I can see that perhaps age.
Yeah, definitely. And all my family are self-employed, self-starters. I'm the only one with a degree and a career. Like maybe the one who plays it safe a little bit. So we did a lot of travelling, and literally from the age of 18, thinking back now, I didn't really think of it as being adventurous or risk taking. And my dad tells me stories where I went to America to do Camp America for 12 weeks when I was 18, and no one picked me up from the airport. And I rang home like, no one's here. And my dad was like ringing people at midnight, having a go. And I can't remember any of this. I was just in Florida having a great summer.
My dad once got so freaked out that I met some people on a bus, and I went up, I went on a hike with them in northern Peru. Apparently I said to them, oh, I'll give you a call in a minute, and I never did. And it was 5 days later. Meanwhile, he's like ringing the British embassy and all sorts of ridiculous. So
yeah, we've definitely got a similar personality background there. And I just think, I think the volunteering, yes, but I did things like Duke of Edinburgh. I did a ski season. What else did I do? All the different jobs and volunteering. And I just think how we were brought up, it was like nothing's impossible.
Yeah.
It was just no argument. Whatever you put your mind to do, you can do. And that's just that's the philosophy by which I live my life. So I don't suffer from the imposter syndrome. I don't ever question I can't do anything. I'll work out how to do it. Yeah. I hope that doesn't make me sound arrogant.
But have you ever had your confidence knocked where you think, well, actually, I thought I could do everything, but that person's made me question myself, and having to get back to your full confidence afterwards?
That's an interesting question, yes, and quite recently so. I've never had to bounce back, I'm really resilient, but I had a big knock to my confidence when I was looking to leave London and was looking for jobs, and I didn't really appreciate the fact that by changing area, all that is known about you isn't known. And I was trying to move back to the West Country, and I was looking for jobs in Bristol, and I kept being shortlisted, and I kept performing well at interview, but kept coming second, and it kept going to the internal candidate. And I just found it really frustrating, because when you're applying for jobs at that kind of level, it's a weekend application, a weekend preparing for interview, 2 days out. By this point, I wasn't being paid for going to interview, because I'd had my 3 pay days, and it was just really emotionally draining. And it didn't stop me, but I did pause. And then, that's the irony of it all, I met my new boss through Twitter and all the networking I do, and things just fell into place. And I'm a big believer in like destiny and fate and things working out for you. And I just think that confidence to pause, that confidence, I had resigned by this point, I knew I was leaving, and everyone thought I was crazy, but my heart wasn't in it. My instinct said to me, you'll be right, you'll get another job. And I was confident enough to know that something would come up, and then something, like the perfect job for me, came up.
Yeah.
So
I always think these kind of things happen once you've got to that point where you're feeling really tested and you're feeling a bit tired, and it's like the next thing when, oh, something's happened again, off you go again.
Absolutely. And I think just the authenticity of the women ed movement and the community, we talk about warts and all. Like at every event there's someone crying, not because we've made them cry, because they're sharing deep personal stuff. Yeah. And I have a lot of comments about, oh, you're so this, you're so that, but I do share the challenges and the difficulties as well. And I will do a talk at one of our future events about the kind of the things I had to overcome to get to where I've got to. It hasn't necessarily been easy, but I haven't let it push me back either.
So we did the post-colonial literature, and then having a look at your other hats, it always seems like leadership's in there. So it's something you're passionate about, bringing the best out in people.
Yes, yeah, definitely. So what are you thinking about in particular? Or
just going back through all of your training and your roles, and then one thing that really interested me, mobilising a choir of 250 students from year 2 to year 13.
Right,
that sounds tricky.
So I think I've definitely got a natural leadership streak, but I have had to refine it over the years. And I see all these opportunities for emerging leaders I didn't have when I was that leader. That I was in the first cohort of MPQSL, I was the guinea pig and it wasn't run very well, and things like that. So I'm the kind of person, when something's not working, I want to get involved to make it work. So I was volunteered very early on to deliver some of the teaching school activity for the National College. So I've been facilitating the National Professional Middle and Senior Leaderships now for 2 or 3 years. I became an SLE, a specialty leader with education, for my networking leadership across the trust. So that all kind of fell into place. So I do a lot of the teaching school stuff, which again crosses over very nicely with the women ed stuff. Then when I got moved into this current role at head office, we have this big conference every October for all of our staff at Harris. And historically it's been split three ways for support staff, SEND staff and teaching staff. And they wanted this year for us to be all under one roof. So Jay's our full-time event organiser and Jackie, the principal of school improvement, and I basically created an event for 2,800, I think it was in the end, people. So it was the week after the Women Ed conference, and everyone's saying, "Oh, Women Ed's so smooth this year. Like, you've got 250 people here. Well done." And I was like, "I've got 10 times this next weekend. Like, this doesn't even faze me this year." Whereas the year before, we'd all been thinking it was quite a big event. But I also am a big believer in an event for 50 is the same as an event for 500, because once you've got your structure there, it's just about scaling it up or scaling it down. But the choir was honestly one of the hardest things I've ever done. Which it shouldn't, like, it doesn't look it on paper, but trying to mobilise all these children with all these teachers from all over London and get their parents on side and get them all to rehearsals and work with an external choir lead and sort out the technical stuff in the theatre and then on the day get them all there, and we had an issue with breakfast and transportation, and it was all worth it because, I'm not sure if you've seen the video, their four songs were just beautiful, and to see these 5-year-olds to 18-year-olds and staff all performing to this massive auditorium, I mean, unprompted, all the lights were down, the staff got their mobile phones out and everyone's doing their take that moment with their torches. Like, we were, like, there were a lot of wet eyes in the room and the kids were proud. Behind the scenes we were swans and we were kind of like frantically keeping everything together. But
so what songs did they do?
Okay, so we were working with Sue Bishop, I've known for years. She works at the Music Merton Foundation and they mobilise all the primary schools in Merton each year to go to the Royal Albert Hall, and they commission and write their own pieces. So because of all the copyright issues, they did two songs that had written, and then we wanted some of the popular songs that the staff would know as well. So my favourite, Lean On Me, was just lovely. But we basically looked at songs where the themes or the language resonated with the vision of the event, and it was all about every child, every day, everywhere, and about the kind of the resilience and the resilience needed in order to flourish. So there was
That's lots of,
it was lovely.
So getting the kids to remind you why you're doing it.
Absolutely.
Okay, and then so back into your career. So 6 months as an event organiser.
Yes.
Yay, event organisers.
It was, I'm good at organising events, but corporate events didn't really do it for me.
Yeah.
So at that point I was fighting the urge to become a teacher. Everyone always said to me, you'll be a teacher. My gran was a teacher, my mum was a nursery, and I was like, no, I don't think I will be. I want to go into journalism, I want to go work in like media production. And saw this events job, but it was basically an office job. Like, you do as you know, like months and months and months of prep for a 2-day event, but then back in the office, and I'm just not an office person. I just can't sit still and be doing the same thing every day. But it gave me skills. I think a lot of my skill set actually comes from working in hospitality. I was a waitress from the age of 11. I worked weekends and evenings, running bars, running restaurants, having to do the kind of like working with lots of different people and keep them all happy. I can remember my NQT interview, like, what skills can you bring to the classroom? Well, my manager can turn me around and I will tell you what every single person in the restaurant is eating, where they're at and what they want next. That's the same as a classroom. I will know where every child is. And
it's very true. But public facing and engaging with
holding things together, being a swan, efficiency. I think there's a lot that actually is how schools are run as well.
And so your new role is starting officially in January.
Yes.
And you'll be a head teacher.
Yes.
And so where is that based? You did mention it before.
It's two roles in one. So basically, I'm changing trusts. I'm going to work for GLF, which is the Glyn Learning Foundation. I met John, my new boss, via Twitter and social media. He's the co-founder of the Heads Round Table. Lots of resonation with what's going on with Women Ed. And he and I met back in the spring at one of the conferences at the Excel Centre, actually. Was it the Academy? What was that, March? It's the Academy show, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe.
We met at that. So he wanted me to go and work for him, and I wanted
to have new opportunities, and these different jobs came up, and this job really appeals to me because it's the head teacher of a year 7 startup school. So I'm relocating, I'm moving to Oxfordshire in the spring to open up a brand new school that's being built to open next September, but the role is also the regional director for that cluster of schools. So there's a primary school in Banbury, our secondary school in Didcot, then there's another primary school in Banbury, and then there's a primary school in Didcot, and I'm basically going to be creating the collaborative hub for those four schools because it's quite far from head office, which is in Epsom.
Okay, and that school will have a specialism in STEM, is that correct?
Yes, although I'm changing it to STEAM.
Good.
So,
excellent.
Yeah, a lot of my background is performing arts and making sure that drama, dance, media, music have a presence in school curriculum.
Do you ever conduct your meetings in the medium of interpretive dance?
No, I don't.
Can I suggest that going forward?
I would love to see that. I'm a big believer in the kind of the power of the arts in developing young people, and part of my ethos is about developing the whole person and not just a person who can perform in an exam. So we have got a STEM specialism, which makes sense because Oxfordshire's got loads of great stuff going on with the two science parks, but I want to make sure that arts has a profile. So my mate Nick at STEAM Co has been talking a lot about the fact that STEAM is like a recognised acronym now, and making sure that it has a profile. I'm really excited, and the difference with this school in particular is that quite often when you're in startup schools, you are in like prefabricated buildings for the first few years and you move into a build. My school is being built for 1,200. It'll be ready for 1,200, and we'll have 120 in it for the first year.
And will you be looking to collaborate with people who, like Nick, who work in STEAM and in those areas? How can they connect with you on
Absolutely.
What you want to do
so
there?
Basically, I'm looking at how to be creative with the space, because I'm going to have stacks of space. And I see all of those collaborative partnerships I've established through Women Ed, through Harris, through the last few years, as bringing a lot of value, not only to my school, but into the area. So I'm talking to Graydon about having a kind of a coaching pilot at the school. I'm talking to people like Jazz and Catherine, who I'm friends with, who facilitate. They can run training out of the school that my staff can go to and other staff can come to. I had a really interesting visit. I can't think what it's called now. There's an incubator at Hackney Community College.
Emerge Education.
Yeah, so yeah. I went to visit them a couple of weeks ago about having an ed tech space where almost think tank, where people can have space, they can be trialing stuff, they can be piloting it with my kids and my staff.
That's cool.
Because I think the focus on computing and coding is great, but it can be quite disjointed to the rest of the curriculum.
Yeah.
And I want to make sure that this is integrated and it's meaningful and actually it's cross-curricular. So by having live briefs with industry,
before it goes too far, and then they're trying to sort of backsell it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And look, we had a really good initiative at my last school where we had artists in residence based in the school. So postgrad students who need art space can come and run workshops. So I'm trying to be quite creative about how we can bring people into that space to create a community and to create a bit of a buzz and bring value to the children in that space.
So it's really interesting. So I have a friend that's just returned from, she's done a couple of years now over the summer working with things like the Tinkering School, and there's a new one called Project Ember. And these are kind of projects. The Tinkering School were on TED, they did a talk on TED, where the kids are encouraged to use tools that perhaps previously people have said, no, it's really dangerous. That actually, you know, work out how to use it safely and create, projects, hands-on and that kind of thing. And I suppose this ties into the whole sort of makerspace thing. And now she's come back and she's trying to find work in this space. But I was just trying to get a sense and whether how we relate to the States, for example, in that area. Mm. You know, do you think it's slower or is it just different or...
I don't know. I think there's schools doing things differently over here. I think we're quite traditional. Yeah. And when you see what's happening in Finland, there was that really interesting article about that school in Germany with no curriculum, where the children are going to budget and it's like self-learning, and part of it is they have to go and plan a trip. And then we've got School 21 that I'm going to visit tomorrow. Like there's interesting things going on. That the teaching leaders, future leaders are rebranding and relaunching tomorrow at School 21. So I'm going for a tour in the morning. So I think there's interesting things going on, but I think it's in...
pockets of best practice rather than across the whole system. There's the, I don't know much about them, but the Ashoka schools are doing some interesting things. So I'm really excited about having this two-term lead-in where I can go and visit schools and do my research and really like find out what's working, what's not working, where the gaps are, and have time to like properly think. And because it's exciting to have a blank bit of paper and it's liberating, but it's also like, where do you draw the parameters in at the same time? And I'm also really mindful of the fact that I know what's working, not working in London, in a city, urban, socioeconomically deprived area. Where I'm moving to is quite a different space. The parents are very different. I don't even know what the pen portrait of the kids I'm going to be working with is, because I've got my numbers, but I don't know what that translates into. So it's also, I'm very mindful about not going in with a fixed mindset about what I want to do. I've got three curriculums in my head and three staffing models in my head, and I want to make sure I get the right people in the building and that we evolve with the community.
And you were looking to recruit that team now, is that right?
From January.
So, okay.
Yes, I've got, basically from January we're going to be doing recruitment, and I'm again thinking about how to do recruitment a little bit differently and almost do a bit of an open recruitment window for who would be interested in coming on that journey with us and what they think they could bring to the table.
Yeah.
I think we shut doors when we advertise for a 0.4 geography
role.
Teacher.
Yeah, or, I completely agree with that.
Yeah, and like things, for example, that it's going to be a small school, we're going to have budget constraints, and we're not going to have a full staffing structure for the first few years. So plan A would be, I would have like part-time foundation subjects, but plan B would be, I'd have a primary school specialist who could teach cross subjects. And I don't mind which plan I go with initially, I want the right person.
Yeah,
I said the same to the parents about languages. I did French and German at school because that was the option. I would like to have done Spanish, but we tried to recruit Spanish for 3 years at my last school and we couldn't find the right person. So why are we still trying to do Spanish? I'd rather have an amazing French teacher to inspire the children to learn French. So I think it's about working out what your non-negotiables are, but also having a little bit of flexibility about how you meet your visions and your goals.
The people with the skills and with the enthusiasm.
Yeah, I think it's more important about the person you put in front of the children, and are they going to like be really passionate educators? And they all need to learn a language, but whether that's German, French or Italian or Spanish, really it's about the learning of the language, because once you become a linguist, you love languages, you learn other languages.
Okay.
But that's how I kind of see it.
So going back to the false dichotomy of work-life balance,
yes.
How are you going to combine the new role with Women Ed?
I've been asked that a lot. I don't see it as being an issue because I've got a full-on job now.
Yeah, okay.
I don't see them as being separate beings. I'm already planning an event in July for Women Ed. It was really interesting going to an event a few weeks ago with the heads from the local area. I've already got connections up there via Twitter, via Women Ed, or they've got staff in their schools who I know through Women Ed. So if anything, I think it's going to help my transition to a new area,
yeah,
where potentially I could be quite socially isolated in a new role in a new school, not knowing anyone, but actually I've got people to go out for a drink with.
And what's London going to do without you?
Have a sleep. The thing is, it's only an hour away. Like, I've still... Our head office is...
Why did you leave?
Why did I leave London?
Yeah.
Did
you just have enough, or...?
I've been looking to leave for a while. Like, I think being brought up in Devon...
Yeah.
Spending 6 years in Kent. Since I've been in London for 12 years, and I've moved further and further out. I crave green space.
I'm from the Isle of Wight.
Well, I'd like to live by the sea, ultimately. When I went up on Saturday...
We need you there. Go and sort the ghetto out.
On Saturday, when I was driving up to Didcot, I was driving... I came off the M4 and I was driving through the countryside, and all I could see was sky and green. And I just felt this...
And the power station.
And the power station. All I could feel was this inner calm and this peace. And my happy place is the beach and going for a walk on the beach. And I would love to have been able to see the sea. But when I look out of any window in my school, I see fields, I see green. And it's like, my dad thinks it's hilarious because they retired and bought a farm when I was 18 and went to uni. I'm not a farmer's daughter. I don't really do mud. I've got wellies, but they're purple. I don't really do the kind of the feeding the animals bit. But I do appreciate... I don't eat animals, so I don't want to feed them.
Okay.
But I don't... I do appreciate just... You've got a different headspace.
Yeah.
And also pace of life.
It's just less noise. Like, visual noise.
Everything. Yeah. Everything. And at the moment,
I am really busy all the time and something's got to give.
Yeah.
So I'm removing myself from a very busy space. And I'll still be busy, but a different kind of busy.
It's funny, when you live somewhere where you don't have 20 options in the next hour, you know, actually it allows you to focus on what you're doing because you're not having people inbound stuff all the time as well.
So I am excited, but again, like when John and I were talking, John's my new boss, we're talking about the job, I was looking for Bristol. He said it's Oxford, so that's in the M4. When it's a bit different to Bristol, I went, well, it's closer to home than where I am now. But actually, it's quite a nice position being in the middle of the country, easy to get home, easy to get back into London. So I'm seeing a bit of a women-led hub kind of like being created where people can come and come to events.
So that's interesting. So I've just taken over. There was a meetup group of 800 UK edtech startups and they needed someone to take it over because it was going to disband.
No, right.
So I helped take it over in terms of, you know, keeping it together. But the point there is that that's very London-centric at the moment. So I suggested, you know, let's have regional hubs. So mix them up. Because I think there's someone based in Oxford at the moment. So
brilliant.
Doing one, maybe one in Liverpool. So
everything's London-centric. And we've had that with Wynedd a lot, that everything's south based as well. Hence why our next event's up in Sheffield. And we're trying to alternate the national events north and south. And it's about mobilising the troops, really. I saw a report this morning about people, like groups like Teach First need to stop doing London and go and do the cold spots. Well, they've still got a lot of work to do in London, but I think I can see a kind of a ripple effect of waves coming out of London. And a lot of people said to me, if you were staying in London, I'll come work for you. But a lot of other people said to me, I'm going to be leaving London in 2-3 years' time. Can I tap you up for a job then? I was like, hell yeah.
I bet what's really interesting is looking at people who previously lived in London who are in that 30 to 39 band that you mentioned, where you have the drop off.
Living in the
Cotswolds. I bet they're starting to move out of London as well.
Absolutely.
So does WomenEd collaborate with any initiatives worldwide? So we've talked about North South. What about internationally? Are there any other things that people should know about in this area?
That's a really good question. So we do the national one, first of all, that we've got a lot going on in the UK and we've got really good relationships with Teach First, Teaching Leaders, Future Leaders, the DfE and other kind of like national reach. We've had a lot of interest beyond the UK, but we have to keep reminding ourselves is the five of us who are the national leaders, we've all got full-time jobs, several of them have got families, and everything we do is volunteer on top of the day job. And we really want to keep true to our core values that it's not about money, it's about people and relationships, hence why everything's an unconference. We try not to have any money passing hands apart from the national event, which needs a little bit of money. So it's how we scale up but stay true to ourselves. And as we're seeing with things like the mats, some of them scale up too quickly and they implode and they lose their way along the way. So we're really mindful that we need to stay to our mission, stay to our values, make sure the right people are getting on the bus and things will naturally mobilise. But just in the spirit of how we were conceived and was being born on social media, we've got a lot of engagement, in particular in Australia, America and Canada. So US WomenEd launched 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, I saw that. So,
yeah,
so that's an official part of what you're doing?
The thing is, what I find really interesting about it all is we are a hashtag. And Microsoft said to us 2 years ago, you need to like paint in it. We're like, it's a hashtag. You need to own it. What if someone tries to make money out of you? We'll be really flattered. Like, we're not in it to make money. We're not in it. It's a community-owned grassroots movement.
Yeah.
So in theory, anyone can set up an account. I don't want them to go and all do that. What we've got is the regional leaders setting up an account in each UK region. So we've had a lot of activity and interest from America.
Which is similar to the Teach Meet model of different chapters.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also about that locality and like relationships in your local area and joining up the dots in your local area. That we can do that nationally, but where we live is obviously a barrier. So we've had people, the American educators, engaging in our staff room blogs and Digi Meets. There's some really exciting stuff going on in Canada and Scotland. So it's really where the appetite is. So they asked if they could do a Twitter chat a few weeks ago and there wasn't loads of people engaging, but that doesn't matter. Like, it needs to start somewhere. So we've set up the WomenEd US account and I can see Australia probably being the next one because there's lots going on there with gender equality in the education system as well. And that's just really exciting, like, just to think how things have grown in the last 18 months and the kind of the cascade and the spheres of influence. That
it's putting something visible and then people rally around it, isn't it?
So yeah.
You've got the brand, you've got, you know, people know you're very visible as well.
We're very visible, but we lead with our values and we lead with who we are and the relationships within the community. And that's where I think we're quite unique, that we're not trying to dominate. Mm-hmm. We're trying to join up the dots.
Yeah.
We're working with all the other partners in collaboration, that we're just trying to make sure that information gets out to people, because a lots of things are poorly communicated. So we see it, and that's why our logo is an amplifier.
Yeah.
It's about us amplifying voices, amplifying messages, making sure that people find out, because if you're not on Twitter, you don't know half the time.
That's very true. I mean, that is a really interesting one, and I've pondered about whether I could do some kind of event where you get what might be called connected and unconnected educators in a room together to discuss, you know, their various viewpoints, or because I think a lot of the discussion is you have connected educators or progressives or whatever, and then how do you get the others on board to that? And I don't know if you have a viewpoint on that and whether there's a right or wrong way, or
absolutely. I'd love to work with you or something like that, because I think networking, to me, there's so much power in networking. And I met with Ben at Leadership Matters last week. He told me about this book about connecting. What is it called? Is it Day of Pink? The Connector. Sure. There's this book. I'll have to find it for you. And he was saying you're just really good at doing the dots.
You're a Malcolm Gladwell. I think that is it called
a, it is Gladwell. It is Gladwell. Yeah. I always think about that moment in Bridget Jones where she does the awkward introductions.
Okay.
But I'm quite good at sort of seeing two people who I know and introducing them via email or DM, because I can see where things will resonate.
Yeah.
And I think that takes me 2 seconds, but they'll both really appreciate the introduction. So I do. That's what I would have liked when I was emerging. Going back to the original question, that would be really interesting. I think one of the biggest barriers of social media is the fact that people just see it's time consuming.
Yeah.
And it is time consuming. I joined Twitter about 4 years ago, and I just didn't get it initially. I didn't see the value of it. I just saw it. Doing Facebook was easier. And then I revisited it, must have been 3 Januaries ago, where I saw something. I think it was a blog by Jill Berry. Stephen Lockyer had shared it, and it took me to Staff Room, and I found Staff Room. And I think Staff Room's a really nice introductory space to Twitter, because it's safer, it's slower, you can dip in and out of it, and you're in control of what you consume. Twitter can be quite overwhelming.
Yeah.
And I spent half a term in Canada with my best mate from school, and she went, your phone is just like, there's just notifications all the time, it stresses me out. But it's how you manage that.
Yeah.
And you learn how to communicate in a kind of different way. But it's just funny when I've got to the point now where a lot of my, I'm not sure, like on-screen connections have actually become off-screen friendships.
Yeah, and that's the important thing, isn't it?
It's about the relationships. Yeah. And I spoke to two people on the phone yesterday who I know through Twitter. Last weekend, I spent the weekend with Jazz. And it's actually really meaningful relationships where I wouldn't have met them had it not have been for Twitter or Woman Ed. And they are really shaping who I am as an educator, actually.
Yeah interesting. Well, on that one, so you mentioned, so you're not going to worry about getting a patent, which is, yeah,
people know who you are.
You're not Samsung or Apple.
No, we're not trying to make money and stop teaching and set up a company. That's not who we are.
But if there are, because there are many, if there are you know, whether it's ed tech companies or people listening who want to support Women Ed's mission in some way, you know, is there anything that you need, or, you know, whether it's sort of partnership funds or you know, supporting events, or are you happy with how it is?
And see, that's a really interesting question. And I think the steering group, the five of us, have a meeting last Sunday, and we're talking through our card targets for the next year, where we see ourselves going. And I think as soon as money passes hands, there is an understanding, or there's kind of an expectation of things. And at the moment, the beauty of who we are and what we do and why we do it is that it's about relationships, and no one owns any of our views.
Mm.
And you give what you want to give. There's no judgment if you don't go to an event. Some people come to all the events because they can. Others dip in and out of Twitter, and it's on your terms. We've had a lot of offers. We took the Microsoft off of the first event simply to mobilise and get our first event going. We're kind of at the point where we don't really need them, but it's still lovely working with them. So also, like, we haven't got anyone doing our finances, we haven't got a bank account. As soon as you start going, that's like the next level, and we're not quite ready for it yet. We want to really make sure that what we are doing is, it's being amplified, it's being cascaded. We've got people joining with the community, people know who we are, what we're doing, why we're doing it. We want to collate the testimonials of the impact. We've got a lot of people messaging us to say, I got a promotion, I got a pay rise.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
so
citing.
So documenting all the case studies that you make.
Absolutely. But that's time consuming in itself, which is why we've got the regional leaders, but we need them to have opportunities to really grow in that role as well. So at the moment, I think we're just quite happy with where we're at and the value we bring. And you either choose to connect or you don't. And there's no kind of obligation. Like, people talk to us about having membership fees and you getting goodie bags and stuff like that. Like, that's not who we are.
Yeah.
It's not who we are. We just go for the very simple face value. What you see is what you get.
Good answer. Okay, so the EdTech podcast. So we've been talking about women ed and all of this. And obviously the value of tech, I can see already in Twitter, and, you know, actually establishing some of those relationships and communicating and amplifying your goals with women ed. But are there any other ways that tech has a role to play in gender equality in education? If so, what is it?
That's a really good question. So for me, it's, there's a couple of things going on either at school or out of school. So one of the big things that Microsoft had talked to us about a lot was how traditional the profession is, re-meetings, for example, or information sharing, that you all need to be in the room at the same time together. And Harris, for example, we've got the 42 academies across London. I will drive an hour and a half for a meeting for an hour with 30 people who've also all driven the same amount of time and drive home again. And yes, it's a productive meeting, but is that the best use of my time and energy when actually it's a four-hour window for a one-hour meeting? And Microsoft just can't believe that we don't use video conferencing. I went to the new Teach First, very snazzy offices in Greenwich for a meeting a few weeks ago, and there was two of us in the room, and we had this amazing technology system where people had been Zoomed in and we were all chatting. I didn't really feel like they weren't with us. But all that is investments, and a lot of schools are quite traditional spaces, technology-wise, haven't got the budgets to do it. So I think going back to that innovation, creativity, flexibility of working patterns, why can't that part-time mother, middle leader be at home with the kids in bed and accessing an SLT meeting? But for me, it would remove some of the barriers for leadership in particular. With my professional learning hat on, I think there's, again, like courses, like people have to go to a hotel room for a whole day and pay a few hundred pounds. There's different ways of learning. I signed up for, but didn't actually complete, a future learning course recently, where there's lots of like online training opportunities now.
Yeah.
There's an apps market, an emerging apps market, quite a competitive apps market, really. It's a bit wood for the trees, I think, with quite a lot of the apps that are happening.
Yeah, I read there's like 350,000 educational apps.
Yeah, it's tricky. And when I went to see that, what they called Emerge Education,
yeah.
My question is always like, how much contact do you actually have with the schools about what the schools need? That actually, I think quite a lot of things in education is it's someone's idea about what they think will work, but actually who's actually spoken to the classroom teacher about what's gonna help them make their life more manageable. So
having something like your EdTech hub at school,
I hope will really help.
Closer, anyway.
I went to the mental health teacher meet at Michael Carter School back in May, and their kids have designed and built an app for mental health. So it's a peer-to-peer app. That's just amazing. So for me, that's them learning EdTech skills, learning leadership, but also supporting one another's well-being. So that's a kind of a triangulated win-win, really.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's about, I think I'm a massive advocate of technology, but the flip of it is, I spent the summer in Tanzania teaching, supporting teachers who didn't even have pencils and paper, and watching A-level physics and chemistry lessons with 60 kids in the room where they had to remember, they had to know their stuff. They had to write out all the diagrams and chalk on the board, and they had to then wipe it out and do it again for the next lesson. You can't. It really was a kind of an epiphany for me about how reliant we are on technology.
Yeah, yeah.
And I came back, and you know, when you just kind of get that resonance. I came back, and Krista and Lisa were going off to Ghana with independent thinking at half term, and Nina Jackson started the naked teaching hashtag, which is always tongue in cheek. I love Nina. And it went, got to the TES, and there was this big hard Twitter thing about having a naked teaching day where you downed tools.
I saw that.
And just go back to your craft. And that just really resonated with me, that even with training, we ran five conference days in Tanzania for these 150 teachers, and you were allowed three bits of flip chart paper for each of those events, and some blue tack and a couple of ball pens. I would normally spend hours, and I'm quite strict about PowerPoints, transitions and all the fuzz, like all the kind of the finicky bits, but even still, I spent hours planning my content. I know my stuff.
Yeah.
I could plan that on a bit of paper in an hour.
I think there's a Steve Jobs quote, something like, if you really know your stuff, you don't need a PowerPoint anyway. Obviously, he had...
We hide behind it.
And actually, how many people would feel really nauseous now if you said, okay, you have to go and do your day job today without any technology? So I guess it's using it to promote your ideas or your knowledge, but not becoming reliant on it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And like all the teach meets I go to and I organise, it's a bit... PowerPoint or now Prezi heavy, and actually the most powerful ones, the most memorable ones, are the ones where they stand there and they talk from the heart and they share. And we organised some public speaking training for some of our central team, and we had to all do these 4 or 5 minute speeches to each other, and it really was like being naked. It was so exposing, because if you think about our assemblies, our training, our briefings, everything is so technology driven. Kids and staff are just bombarded with imagery and messaging and audiovisual. Actually, the beauty and the power of those like really quiet moments have more impact these days because they're so few and far between.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, we're coming to the end now, so just a few more questions. So who are your favourite icons or inspiration? Like, I'm sure there's many, many, many.
In education or in life?
Both. So if you want to pick a couple for me.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, gosh, where to start? Okay, so like life icons, idols, people who inspire me, it'd be like the stock favourites. Like Maya Angelou is one of my favourite writers. Although, I'm going to say his name wrong now, Khalid Hussein, who wrote The Kite Runner, is also one of my favourite writers. Definitely writers are one of my inspiration channels, but people who explore and share these really authentic journeys, and that's where Maya Angelou, I think, really, really inspires me. You've also got people like just Nelson Mandela, like these leaders who just break through barriers and stay humble and stay loving throughout it all. So there'd be some that kind of question, who would you invite to a dinner party, dead and alive? People who inspire me in the kind of the day job, there's some really interesting head teachers who I follow on Twitter who are like breaking boundaries and who stay really true to themselves. These names probably come up all the time, but like people like John Thompson and Tom Sherrington, Helena Marsh, they're all heads round table, Kezia Featherstone, they aren't afraid to be themselves and they make difficult choices to not kind of conform. And I really respect that because I think there's too many conformists in the system and things will never change if everyone just does as they're told all the time. In my day-to-day job, there's one principal in particular who I just absolutely love working with, Nikki Graham at Chapman 100, and she's kind of like really helped shape me as a leader. And when my boss asked me, which head are you going to be like when you become a head, I said I'd hope I'd be like Nikki. And then through Women Ahead, oh my god, I could wax lyrical. I've met so many people. I can honestly say I think each and every person who I connect with through Women Ahead inspires me in different ways. The most recent event I can think about was Friday night when we had a networking event at Greenwich, and Benny Bonsu, if you're not connected with her on Twitter, she's just a powerhouse. She is a kind of teacher by day but a B-Sky-B sports commentator by night,
because they have a really progressive women's,
just brilliant. She's got Ghanaian heritage, brought up in America. She did this really powerful talk on Friday night about being born of Ghanaian descent, being educated in America, then moving to the UK, then being the only black female commentator in the Olympics, being on the SEB co steering group for kind of like representation of diversity at the Olympic 2012. She's just amazing. And we met via Twitter, she's got thousands and thousands of followers, and she asked me to be a coach. And I was like, what? Like, why do you need a coach? Like, you can coach me, mate. And she just said, but it's precisely that thing, that actually you spend so much time supporting everyone else, I want a bit of me time. And in the few months that we've connected, she's got a promotion, she's got a pay rise, and she just needed a little bit of chat time. So she's massively, really inspiring. And she brought her colleague Adam along on Friday night, who did a he for she presentation. And I really respect the men who are standing up saying, I'm a feminist. Justin, the president in Canada.
Like, I was just about to say.
Yeah, Justin Trudeau, like, him and Emma Watson, they're definitely on there for who inspire me, that they are really mobilising in the message and challenging stereotypes. Also, Michelle Obama, like, she's an absolute powerhouse. So I'm probably not saying anyone would expect me to say.
Yeah.
But I think for me, one of our mantras, as well as being 10% braver, is being defined by your soul, not your role. And I think what all those people have in common is they're really authentic leaders. It's about their core values. They've got a conviction and integrity to fulfill their mission, their vision, and not be compromised along the way.
Yeah. Well, that's quite an inspiring message to finish on. So thank you very much, Hannah.
My pleasure, Sophie. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Don't forget, if you're not already, you can subscribe via iTunes or Stitcher or Pocket Cast, and you can follow on Facebook or Twitter and Instagram. I can't wait to get your feedback on this or any of the episodes you've heard so far.
Bye-bye.